Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
The producers of this podcast recognize the traditional owners of the land on which it's recorded. They pay respect to the Aboriginal elders past, present, and those emerging.
The following podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature and is not suitable for children.
Russell Street was thrown into a scene of mass panic by the blast. The first explosion went off just before 1 o'clock when a car blew up outside the police headquarters.
Well, just a few minutes ago, a car bomb exploded outside the police station here in Russell Street. There was the sound of one massive explosion. We were sitting in our office, our Eyewitness News office, just around the corner. The glass was shattered in the windows of our office. After that, there were several more explosions, the sound of probably fuel in the car exploding. Russell Street was in a complete state of chaos for seconds. Policemen, policewomen were screaming. Everybody was in a state of complete hysteria.
Three cars were destroyed in the six explosions. There was massive damage to nearby buildings.
That was the 27th of March 1986, the event that came to be known as the Russell Street bombing, as it was reported that night on Channel 10 Melbourne's Eyewitness News. Regular listeners to Australian True Crime will know it's an event that features in many true crime stories. Our friend and regular guest, former homicide detective Charlie Bezina, narrowly escaped serious injury, or worse, on that day. You'll hear more about that shortly.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
In episode 99 of Australian True Crime, we spoke to retired Chief Inspector Bob Bailey, who was part of the legendary Victorian Armed Robbery Squad in its heyday and was an eyewitness to the Russell Street bombings. He explains the moments just before the first blast like this.
I walked up Latrobe Street and turned into Russell Street, and there was two parked cars, and I saw the Commodore parked across the north door, and I've gone, that's a bit strange. And it was bloody eerie because I looked left and right. There was no one. Basically, at that 1 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon, you would have buses, traffic, people walking everywhere. There was nothing apart from one car that was driving north through the intersection of Latrobe Street and Russell Street towards where I was standing in between the parked cars. I'm 12 metres away from the Commodore. And I looked at my watch and I said, I've got an appointment at 1 o'clock, and I'm just about to run across the road. And I thought, no, I'll let this car go through first. And I'm glad I did, because I would have been standing beside the Commodore when it went up.
You'll notice we've reissued that episode for you this week in case you'd like to know more about the event, because as you'll hear, it's still pretty triggering for this week's guest, the legendary defence lawyer Bernie Barmer. He's known as Bernie the Attorney in some circles, and make no mistake, the circles Bernie moves in are not for the faint of heart or for bullshit artists. And at no other time is the real integrity behind Bernie's wit and charm more evident than when we broach the topic of the Russell Street bombings. That's coming up soon. But first, he's very famous, some might say infamous, in legal slash criminal circles. Emily and I have been chasing this interview for literally years, but you may not know a lot about Bernie Barmer, and there is a lot to know. So let's allow Bernie to lay on a bit of razzle-dazzle for us, because he's a showman, and he loves the courtroom. But thanks to COVID, he hasn't been in a courtroom for 2 years, so he's really missing it, and that is our great fortune.
How long have you been practising?
Oh, look, after I got kicked out of school.
Did ya?
Yeah. Apparently you're not allowed to belt up Morris Brothers. I was at Assumption at Kilmore. And
the irony, because they were allowed to belt up everyone.
Yeah, well, kids. He ended up getting 14 years with a 10 minimum for historical sex offending, so I don't know whether I dodged a bullet. But however, it's been an interesting journey, having never done Year 12.
Yeah.
I worked in a bank 12 months and got kicked out of that because I wouldn't cut my hair. And then I got into a tennis team and met a bloke who was a clerk of courts, a fella called Alistair Shine. And I thought, that sounds interesting. So I got into the courts and did their 3-year course in a year, and then walked up to Melbourne Uni. And the sub-dean who passed away recently had a beautiful name for a lawyer called Dick Tracy, Richard Tracy. And he took me under his wing, and I've got a bit of a fight background, and I bounced at the Champion in Fitzroy for 2 years, and with that money paid a barrister, Brian Dennis, to tutor me, and I did law part-time in 5 years, and then, worked for Legal Aid for 5 months, and then worked for Cody DeWires for 6 months, and went to Griffiths and did the McKay inquest for Gianfranco Tazzoni, who was the fella who organised the guns that were used to kill Douglas and Isabel Wilson, and the conspiracy on Donald McKay. Mm. And while I was up there, I thought, oh, bugger this. I'm not good with bosses. So I decided to start my own firm, which I did, I think it was the 1st of June 84. So I've been blazing away ever since.
Now, can I just, just going to have to ask you to stop down for a second,
yeah,
if you don't mind. Could we discuss the client that you just mentioned, just briefly?
Gianfranco Tazzoni.
If you don't mind.
He became a police informer,
yes,
and gave evidence at the inquest. And Jimmy Baisley, incidentally, when I was a clerk of courts, I used to go with the visiting magistrate to all of the jails to do what they did, call complaints and requests of prisoners, to make sure they're all right, et cetera, et cetera. Darcy Dugan, who was my mentor, the old chief magistrate, whose daughter worked for me for 22 years, he said the only bloke in custody when you do complaints and requests that you ever accept a cup of tea from is Jimmy Baisley. And I said, why? He said, because the others piss in it.
Oh, no. Bad income.
So you learn things on the way, don't you?
Jimmy Baisley, eh?
Yeah.
Well, that's nice to know about Jimmy Baisley. But
he recently passed away and in the Costigan Royal Commission. Douglas and Isabel Wilson were found in Rye, and their dog was alive. And at the inquest, he was at the commission. He was asked why he didn't shoot the dog, and he said, "Dogs don't talk."
Was this the Mr. Asia Syndicate, Doug and part Isabel of it? Wilson?
Yeah.
If we can just go back to Tizzoni for a minute, though, I mean that's a pretty heckers client for a young bloke to take on. And if we can talk about Mackay. About the community that he came out of, and about the environment, the marijuana
Griffith,
about the marijuana plantations that were springing up and around there, and the Italian, I mean the Calabrian mafia was allegedly involved in setting up a community and an industry there in Griffith. Let's talk about your, I'm going to say, courage in getting involved in that case. How did that feel at the time?
Oh, look, you don't think about those things.
Do you not?
No.
Because they had a fair sort of, you know, racket in killing blokes who annoyed them.
Possibly. But no, you're just doing your job to the best of your skill and ability.
If your skill and ability weren't up to it, they'd knock you.
Well, not necessarily. They probably wanted to have a look at statements on my file, but didn't get to that.
No. Were you confident? What sort of bloke were you lawyer?
I discovered. Oh, it's probably a bit wild, but I discovered during that hearing that the coppers were bent, New South Wales coppers. So,
well, they might knock you too. I mean,
well, that's why I booked a room in Griffiths and flew to Sydney every night and stayed in Sydney.
Gosh.
So you need some street smarts.
Yeah, you do. But also you need a bit of sort of, you need to love the excitement. You need to be the sort of guy who's loving it a bit.
Just don't wear Target T-shirts.
Yep, okay.
So you just got to hedge your bets. Watch what you say. Don't mislead courts. Then you develop a reputation, and your clients, by and large, come to you because they want you to help them. Some of them become a bit of an enemy, and it's usually because of mental health or drugs. So this, you know, over the journey, there's been a couple have been a bit of a bother, but you know, you work them out.
Yeah, but sometimes when you're do a good job for blokes like that from a community like that in Griffith, sometimes then that can be a bother because sometimes then everyone in the community goes, great, let's make Bernie our guy.
Probably with my naivety, I never saw any, just didn't think of it.
Yeah.
I was up there to do a job.
Did you end up with other clients from that?
No, look, I came back to the firm that I was working with, Cody Dwyer, and left them and started my own show. So it was sort of the catalyst to think that, look, I'm better off starting my own show because, you know, I had this great ability of perhaps not getting on with everybody.
Yeah. And
particularly authority.
I get that, not wanting to have your own boss. That's why I'm sitting here now. Yeah.
So you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So you weren't made any offers you couldn't refuse?
No. In fact, when I left the public service, I had $5,000 superannuation, a wife and three kids then, later four, and you're starting your own show. And I can remember in the first month I earned $157. And I'm thinking, shit.
I know that feeling too.
Yeah.
You start to think, oh, maybe having a boss wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
But it was.
So I rang my a fellow called Bill Sarong who played with Collingwood and North Melbourne, and who I did my articles with. And he gave me a couple of his old skeleton files, and I was over there. I just kickstart, and I'd get up early and get to the watch house early. And being a clerk of court, you knew a few of the coppers, so get in there, pick up clients.
Mm.
On it went.
Roland Legg was telling us the other day about back in the day when they used to parade the people who were had been in the watch house overnight.
Yeah.
On a stage, literally, of a morning, so everyone could see who's in
the zoo. Yeah. It's like a lineup, isn't it?
Did you get to take, you know, pick some people off the stage, maybe?
No, that was probably just a head count to make sure they were all there. I didn't see that, but you were literally at the door talking to them through a wire mesh door. Mm-hmm. There was no facilities. Standing there with your pad, writing your instructions and going into court and say, yeah, I'm ready, let's go.
Mm.
Do the best you can.
You said you had a bit of a fight background, and that's very understating it. Did you pick up some clients from your kind of associations with that world? Because it's really interesting, I find that you're a fighter.
You do. And the other thing is when don't come in for appointments and you go to a fight promotion, you say, why haven't you come in for your appointment? and you pick up the odd, and still do, through the fight family. It's a bit of a misunderstood sport.
Yeah, because I believe you also work with, how would I describe it, underprivileged youth through your fight connections.
Yep.
And it's very well known for that as well.
Yep. Well, we're not the most popular people at court when you're defending.
Yeah.
It can be a bit lonely sometimes, and it's a competitive industry, but it's a rewarding industry. I'll probably suffer frustration because you don't get your own way rather than anything else.
Yeah, I can't imagine the frustration of it, the work that you put in. Similarly, you know, we talk to homicide detectives a lot. The work, the years of work you put in, and to not get the outcome that you believe you should, I reckon I'd do it once in my life and then crack the shit so badly that I'd never do it again.
Well, I think I've got 11 murder files on my books at the moment, but because of COVID, you can't get 12 jurors in a room. So the poor buggers are going to sit on remand for 3 years before they get a trial. And if you get acquitted, and some will, not all, you'd be mightily pissed off.
Yeah, that's right. You've done 3 years already.
Yeah.
Because you don't get, it's not like you can get that time back, really.
Well, the people on the street don't see that sort of thing. Okay. And people on that you pass in the street haven't got a tattoo on their forehead. So, well, I'm a thief, I'm a burglar, I'm an ice addict, I'm a murderer. You don't pick them.
No. Speaking of the street, March 27th, 1986, you and, coincidentally enough, Charlie Bazina.
Yeah, he was parked behind the bomb car because he'd gone around the corner to get some camping equipment for his kids. Come back and his bonnet's bent back over the roof of the car and stuff,
Yeah, the Russell Street bombing happened on that day. And, yes, thanks be to God, Charlie Bazina survived by virtue of the fact that he was taking his kids camping that weekend and he went to get the camping gear. But where were you? What happened that day?
Oh, look, I was just coming out. It was 1 o'clock at lunchtime, so I was just coming out into Russell Street. I was a bit inside, a bomb went off, and of course, it's all dirt and dust. So I'm heading out into Russell Street and run into Angela, who was in a pretty poor way.
That's Constable Angela Taylor.
Yeah. Magistrate West was down on the left-hand side of me because he had a thigh injury, I think, and then Donario was down over the road. But there was about 5 explosions. It was
I didn't know that.
Yeah, there was bits of jellyknite that just got tossed around the street and hadn't gone off. And if you ever watch any film, you see a copper walking along and there's another explosion and you see him duck down. So we eventually, took her back in, and being a clerk of courts, and I had been 2 chief magistrates, personal assistant, Alec Vale and Kevin O'Connor. And I knew the layout of the court, so I was able to take her to, it was Mick Quirk's office, he was the chief, and I took her in there.
Don't move too quickly. You literally picked up and carried Constable Angela Taylor, who had been mortally wounded by the explosion. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a
And you carried her in?
Tough day at the office.
Back inside, yeah?
Yeah.
And you carried her into whose office?
Oh, he was the chief. Well, when I was a clerk of courts here, he was the chief's chief clerk of courts.
Mm. And how old were you?
In 86. I'm not telling you.
No, okay. But you're a young man.
Yeah.
You're a young man.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Early 30s.
Okay. Yep. And you've just scooped up this young woman while explosions are still happening, or?
Yeah.
They're still happening.
The residual ones were still happening, yeah.
And you've walked out into the middle of that.
Yeah.
And picked up this young woman.
Took her back in.
And carried her back in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'm taking her into an office. And I'm assuming she was not conscious at any stage.
Yeah, no, she was talking. She was talking, yeah.
What was she saying?
Well, I asked her a name. I can recall her, and I think it's in my statement, she said the bastards. But, you know, the smell, taste and noise still bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
But she just had a lot of clothes. Sorry.
No, that's all right. You take
your time. So, yeah, I rang Triple O and others arrived and then I got evacuated. Oh. Sorry about that. Happens occasionally.
There's very few people who've experienced anything like that. I mean, that's literally, you know, police, soldiers, paramedics are the only people.
Oh, some have seen a hell of a lot worse.
No, that wasn't my point at all. I was saying that that's the ilk of human generally who has seen anything like that.
Well, you sort of, look, you don't think about your own safety. You haven't got time.
Oh, no. A lot of people do, Bernie.
Yeah.
You know, they say there's two kinds of people in this situation, the people running away and the people running to, and you don't find out which one you are until, God forbid, you're in the situation. And so you found out that you're the running to person, which is pretty extraordinary.
Oh, well, she needed help.
Mm. Yeah, she did. Yep, and you gave it to her.
Yeah, unfortunately. She hasn't had the benefit of a career and a marriage, kids, and so on. That's sad.
No, she didn't survive. However,
I think she survived 27 days or thereabouts, yeah.
Yeah, but she knew that someone helped her that day.
I don't know.
Oh, she did, because she spoke to you.
Well, she did. Oh, she was answering questions. I wanted to know who she was because, I mean, her uniform was blown off. You know, the smell of nylon and burnt hair and stuff like that. Yeah. Mm. So, pretty ordinary.
Have you had specific PTSD counselling around?
Sure.
Yeah.
Still do from time to time. Because, you know, there's always a trigger.
Mm.
And, you know, those at home probably. They're the recipients sometimes of, you know, if a plate's dropped and it's just your nerves are gone.
Mm.
Yeah. But anyway, soldier on.
Mm.
How have you managed it, like getting some help, but how, you know, through your career and raising a family and obviously your sport, because you're really involved in the sport, boxing, how have you managed that with the PTSD?
Well, you don't think about it. You just, I'll throw myself in and do it 100%. But yeah, no, you just, look, you do. I'm not going to curl up in a fetal position in the corner and you know, Tony McHugh, the psychologist, you know, he's a bit of an expert in post-traumatic, you know, does a lot of the coppers, the soldiers and stuff like that. So I was put onto him and he was very helpful.
Mm. Yeah, because we've learned that you need that specific PTSD specialist, don't
you? Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't just, you need a plan and stuff. So, yeah.
Mm.
But I'm not a total wreck.
You certainly are not.
No way.
I mean, that's a long time ago now.
86, yeah. And look, sadly, every 10 years anniversary, you know,
yeah.
And I didn't talk about it for 10 years, and Ian Johnson, Then Channel 9 talked me into doing a 10-year doco. Uh-huh. That's when I got a bit sooky-la-la about it because I'd bottled it pretty well, just like my dad who'd fought overseas for 3 years in the Middle East.
Mm.
They were taught to come back and not talk about it.
Yep.
Which is probably dumb in many ways. There's a lot of soldier shipwrecks out there or police shipwrecks out there.
Yeah, well, a lot of them came home and became alcoholics, didn't they, from World War II and from Vietnam, very common.
Well, do you know the worst thing about being an alcoholic?
What?
You're always thirsty.
Yeah.
My mum's grandpa was came back from World War I and never spoke about it, had a bullet in a jar from where he was shot at, like, I think it was Gallipoli. And, yeah, just never spoke about it.
Yeah, Dad was the same. I eventually coaxed him into marching on Anzac Day.
Oh, really?
We were from Broadford, yeah. So the last, say, 9 years of his life, he went to his reunion and I organised his battalion to, after the march, meet at the Emerald Hotel in South Melbourne.
Yeah.
Lewis family are very generous in that way. So, yeah, it's good fun.
Gosh, family's very, very important to you, isn't it?
Sure.
Yeah. You've got a lovely big family, like you yourself, lots of kids, lots of grandkids. That's great. I'm envious, very envious.
Yeah, it's it's no fun swimming by yourself.
It sure isn't.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In episode 17 of Australian True Crime, we spoke to Doug O'Loughlin, a retired member of the Special Operations Group. Doug was at Russell Street on the day of the explosions, and he went on to lead the operation to arrest fugitive brothers Craig and Rodney Minogue for the crime. Craig Minogue, Peter Kamarzik, and Stanley Taylor were convicted of the bombing. Kamarzik, known also as Peter Reed, was later acquitted. Stanley Taylor died in jail of natural causes in 2016, and Craig Minogue continues to serve time in Barwon Prison. Craig's brother Rodney was acquitted of being an accessory to the crime. But in 2020, he was sentenced to a jail term of 3 years and 6 months in Albury District Court after pleading guilty to a series of home invasions and burglaries. That court heard that Rodney Minogue was deeply affected upon hearing in 2019 that his brother Craig and Peter Kamarzik would stand trial for the alleged abduction and rape of two women in the 1980s. One of those attacks was alleged to have happened the day before the bombing of Russell Street Police Headquarters. and the Melbourne Magistrates Court heard that the 19-year-old victim was inside the Russell Street building giving a statement to police at the time of the bombing. There are many suppression orders around this case as it's still before the courts, but Rodney Minogue's defence counsel in Albury told that court that upon hearing of his brother's rape charges, Rodney relapsed into methamphetamine addiction. At sentencing, Judge Sean Grant said that in their youth, Craig Minogue had inflicted on Rodney the expectation that he too would follow a life of crime, that Rodney had had a front row seat to Craig's ways, including witnessing, as a boy, Craig dismembering a human body in the kitchen at their home. We've reissued episode 17 of Australian True Crime as well, in case you'd like to hear more about the arrest of Craig and Rodney Minogue after the Russell Street bombing. What about those cases that you've worked on that have got a lot of media coverage?
Gee, where do you start?
I know, that's what I'm saying. You're one of these guys. Your career is so huge. It's like we don't even know where to start with you.
Oh, look, what... You know, that's the things, some things that really impact you. Like I represented a lady who got charged with attempted murder of her father. Injured him badly when he was in bed. She got locked up, got her out on bail. I was driving, and she lived near where I lived at the time. I was driving her home, and I said, your father's rooting you, isn't she? Isn't he?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I think it got written up a New Idea or Women's Day or something like that, the story. Anyway, moving along, we're able to resolve the case to a recklessly caused serious injury. Father survived. But during that process, we discovered that the mum and sister had left the family environment and went to live interstate. And Duncan Allen, who's now a county court judge, he was the barrister appearing. And after we came out of court, I saw the mum and the sister walking up William Street. So I chased them, reunited them.
Oh, wow.
It was, it was real. It was, they're emotional things. But, it was, A, a good result for her, and, B, to relink her with mum and sister was interesting.
That reminds me.
Because I didn't know what mum and sister were going to say.
No.
Mm.
But I thought I'd give it a go.
Did they know? They would have known, surely.
Well, they would have known after sitting through the court case. Yeah.
Can I? That reminds me of a question I have about the court system. Look, it's controversial, but it's about the gender biases in the system, and I think they probably exist for good reasons, and the stats back them up. But it's troubling. I realise my bias is that when I hear that a woman has killed a man in a situation like that, my first thought is, oh, he must have deserved it, to be honest with you. And I never, ever, ever would think that about a man killing a woman.
Yeah, there can always be a button pusher.
You know, like... I feel.
Look, there's many instances of unfairness in law.
When I realised that about myself, I thought, oh, that's really crook, isn't it? I assume he's an abuser. I assume he's an asshole. I assume she's finally stood up for herself and good on her, what a champion. You must love the fight because it seems to me that You can't be the sort of person who loves the outcome because too often the outcome's crazy, frustrating, wrong. So you must enjoy the battle, do you?
I'm married. I'm still fighting.
Yeah. But, I mean, the fight in court too. I mean, you must enjoy the battle, the matching wits, the...
Yeah. Well, rather than fighting with your fists, you're fighting with your mouth.
Yeah.
It's but it's similar strategies sometimes. And... Yeah. The sad part about not being able to go to court now is you can't pick the body language of your judge.
Yeah.
Or you don't know whether someone's in a room nodding or shaking their head with a witness or.
That would be exciting. That's what we all, when we watch a great court drama, that's what we all get off on, isn't it? And we go, oh, I want to be a lawyer when I grow up.
Yeah, I want to do that.
A lot of people want to sit down and talk to you.
Yeah.
Bernie, can I ask you about a case that I found really interesting and actually so heartbreaking? So I was doing a bit of Googling on you, going back in the files, and there was a case in 2000, I believe, and you defended a woman called Julia Setti.
Yeah.
And it's like the most tragic case. She actually killed her child. But the circumstances around that, it was nothing more than a tragedy. And I just thought, reading about that, I thought you've obviously got such a heart for people with trauma and, you know, difficulties. Can you tell us about that case? Because I actually hadn't heard of it. I think I was living overseas at the time.
Right. It's Julie's a lovely lady. It was sadly she from a strict Italian family, had a child out of wedlock. Strict Italian family were very Catholic, so they weren't very approving of a child out of wedlock. The child was put up for adoption. The prospective adoptive parents tried to integrate Julie into the family cocoon, and Julie was suffering issues. And in the end, because of disagreements with authority, adoption agencies, the Justice Department, for example, she flipped and unfortunately the kid passed away because of her actions and was taken to New South Wales, and that's why the case was in Sydney, because there was no jurisdiction in Victoria.
Just over the border, wasn't it, where it happened?
Yeah, so... fortunately, we were able to present her and point out all these issues, and we had a very good judge with lots of empathy who saw the issues and gave her an opportunity to stay in the community, and she got some help, and hope she's living a happy life now.
I think it's that feeling that the system is set up to benefit the offender, because really what that comes back to is the lack of support for victims. Families,
I think that's getting better though.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think from what we've observed. But if it's your first time in the system, which for most victims' families it is, they're shocked. They're constantly shocked that they're not offered counselling. They're not. Yeah. They're not. They just don't feel supported in a way that they assume they would be, and then they find out that. Oh, the offender's getting all this counselling, the offender's getting all this support, and they feel like that's just crazy.
But they don't get any education, really, when they're in there. You know, they meet like-minded people and they come out with better skills, and, you know, the lack of education in the system is, to my liking, bad.
I heard you say... that really, if you're doing any more than 5 years, it's like
you lose your life.
Yeah. And can you talk a bit more about that? Because I was like, wow, that's really interesting.
The experience that I had of people who've done a really long sentence, they don't ever readjust. I mean, they come out. I saw one who did 12 years recently. I got off the tram and he's walking around with his phone. On Google Maps, and I used to see him at the fights. I said, "Hey, mate, what are you doing?" He said, "I can't effing find my way around." He said, "It's all changed." I mean,
oh yeah,
you know, they go home. They've been in a green tracksuit for 12 years. You know, are they fat or are they skinny? I mean, they've got no clothes, often no pots and pans to cook. So
they can't
budget. On benefits.
You know how they used to, I don't know if they still do, but they always used to tuck everything in all the time. You'd see blokes who'd been in jail a long time. Remember Chopper used to always meticulously tuck his T-shirt into his jeans and he was forever pulling his socks up? You know old blokes who'd been in jail a long time? You could see him a mile away. Everything's tucked in.
Yeah. Well, he was a long-time client of mine.
Chop.
Yep.
Michelle's got a well-known fascination with Chopper, haven't you, Michelle?
Well, yeah, I just used to do, you know, run into him around showbiz circles, as you would know, Vernie.
Yeah.
And I love his wife, little Margaret. I love how little Margaret talks about, I'm trying to get her to come on this show, but she's funny, but I love how she talks about him. It's so beautiful. And she still talks about him in the present tense. He is the love of my life. And how she talks about Mark, obviously, she never calls him Chopper.
He was quite a funny fella, but he was very unpredictable.
Yeah. yeah.
It's I first met him when I was a clerk of courts. You did complaints and requests of prisoners, which I might have mentioned earlier, but he cut himself open and he was lying on the floor in H Division and they were trying to get ambulances and stuff in there because his intestines were about to flow out. Rolled over and started doing push-ups. You go, wow. But I first represented him, the Zayat murder at Bojangles.
Oh, yeah.
We ended up having a falling out, and after many years, Peter Morris from Channel 7 rang me and said, Chopper wants your help. I said, well, I don't take apologies by proxy. Mm-hmm. So he got Chopper to ring me, and I said, what do you want? He said, the New South Wales Homicide Squad were coming down to speak to him about the fella he shot in the taxi in Tasmania had disappeared off the face of the earth, and they wanted to talk to him about it. So we're in the interview room at Homicide down here in St Kilda Road, and they were asking all of the questions out of the underbelly books. And I said, look, hang on. This is not getting advanced anywhere. And Chopper just said, let him go. And I thought, I wonder why he's doing this. And then I thought, I know why he's doing it. Another book, another story. So we had a bit of a laugh about that afterwards. But he wasn't a dummy.
No.
You know, to have a career offending against other offenders on the basis that he thought that they wouldn't go and report him to police. I mean, it's like, you know, that some of the most interesting people, like Linus Driscoll, who got extradited as well, but he was head of the toe cutter gang in the great bookie robbery. They used to go around and say, okay, where's the money? And they didn't pay up. They get the tin snips out and start cutting their toes off.
But the thing about Chopper that fascinates me really, and more so since I've spoken a lot to Margaret, is that he fits so perfectly the profile that we know now, in that he spent the first 5 years of his life away from his mum. He spent that in an orphanage because of his mum's debilitating postnatal depression. And then, after that, he entered primary school because his brain development was delayed because of that. We know now that that happens when you have that separation anxiety from that early age. He entered primary school and had learning difficulties, probably ADHD.
Yeah.
And so he's never caught up. He's teased. The name Chopper was actually a nickname that came from teasing, and he agreed to kind of adopt it in a way to try and fit in, which is heartbreaking to me. And the older he got, the more behind he got at school. It's textbook. It's classic. He went to a boys' home. He went to Turana Boys' Home and other boys' homes. I think he was in Gosford at some stage, boys' home, which is a notorious boys' home for physical abuse and sexual abuse. And statistically, I think it's something like, 48% of boys who've followed that trajectory, even today, end up as adults in prison.
Yeah.
So as much as Chopper Reed, in inverted commas, is the subject of whatever,
And the peer group didn't help.
That's what I mean. But that today is.
It's interesting that you started off talking about the 5 years.
Of course. I mean, to me, that's a story that we never talk about with Chopper because we're so immersed in the kind of comic character that he created very cleverly. But it's a tragedy.
And there's such rigid control when you're in jail.
Yes.
Locked up at 3, you get up at 6, breakfast.
For so many people, it's routine. The first time in their lives they've had that structure.
Yeah. But when they come out and they haven't got that structure, they get a little bit confused about what they're supposed to do at certain times.
That's quite common, isn't it, in your profession, drugs and alcohol? Surely there's...
Predominantly alcohol.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was so dumb, I always thought snorting cocaine was a heavyweight boxer.
Self-medicating is obviously pretty rife because it's a stressful industry.
Yeah.
And, you know, and there's PTSD with or without being involved in a major bombing like you have been. I mean, the things, just the material that you're required to view and analyse every day.
Oh, murder photos, yeah.
Yeah. You know, yeah, I'm not surprised that self-medication is rife.
Doctor told me to keep my fluids up.
Do you think the family court, which is a shit show, do you think it contributes to violence in our culture?
Oh, I wouldn't just isolate family court.
Mm.
It just gets back to the facilities that, you know, DHS have.
Yeah.
You know, they just haven't got enough people, enough money,
and
enough courses to, And, you know, it's all Band-Aid stuff. Their caseloads are too huge, you know, and people then start to fall through the cracks. And then some families don't want people visiting them and saying, look, you've got to have supervised visits with your kids and stuff like that. And they object to it.
Yeah.
They think they're up to scratch. And, you know, there's people on Prozac and Lagactyl for mental health things, and they begin to feel all right, so they go off their medication, and of course, the spiral starts again.
Yeah,
I mean, how do you help? And I think it was Jeff Kennedy who closed the mental institutions and put them out into the street where they don't get their depot shots when they should, and so on. So yeah, I mean, it's easy to point.
But again,
anyway.
You know, there's no votes in preventative measures. In New South Wales, I read a study conducted in New South Wales that said that simply housing people suffering from schizophrenia together in an environment would, they projected, you know, lower crime rates by fantastic statistic, only because so many people suffering schizophrenia end up homeless from not taking medication. And then that leads to oftentimes crimes against them and, you know, just lots of issues.
But getting back to your point earlier that, you know, you have an issue sometimes with sentencing, but if you have a look at the overall picture, I don't know whether about 4 or 5 years ago, of all of the criminal cases dealt with by the county court, 0.08% were appealed to the full court of the Supreme Court, either by defence or prosecution. And of that 0.08, 0.02 were overturned, but they don't tell you the judge is getting it right 99% of the time.
And it's sexual assault.
They demonise it.
It's specifically sexual assault is the one that always upsets me. I always think that, you know, you're a rapist, you don't understand how to.
Yeah. And look, they're extremely hard to defend because of the legislation.
All of it's hard. Yeah. I understand that. It's they're hard to convict and it's all difficult. But that's the one that upsets me specifically. And you see, even if they're convicted 6 years over and over and over again for raping people, you know, so that's just a particular pet peeve of mine.
How many years do you think they should get?
The rest of their fucking life, because they don't understand. That's what I think.
But you can't lock someone up for the rest of their life.
You can. You actually can.
In very, 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 very small number of cases.
Because why should you let them out? Or like, will we nominate one of your daughters as the person they get when they get out? Because they get one of us.
Yeah, I don't think they'd get to trial.
But this is my point. You got someone like Peter Dupas or someone like that, that's saying to him, after enough times, this is a man who rapes someone every time he gets out from the age of 15. Okay, you can have another one in 6 years. In fact, you can probably have another 4 because what will happen is when you get out, you'll rape one and we'll catch you, and then in the time you're waiting to go to trial, you'll go and rape another couple in the Dunnies at Rosebud or wherever. So you'll get another 4. You can have another 4 in 6
years. Doesn't
that
come back to the point about education when they're in there?
You can't. You're not going to educate Peter Dupas or any of these.
No, but you're broad brushing the whole situation.
Yeah, because I'm a woman. You're not going to get raped, Bernie. I might.
Men get raped.
Very rarely.
How do you know?
Because I can read the stats and I do read them constantly. Yeah, but they
might. The victim mightn't complain.
You know for a fact, Bernie Barnes.
I've done more likely to get raped than you are.
I know you have.
However.
I think you're broad brushing it.
I mean, just to have a. We live in a civilised society. You can't just say, okay.
It's a lot more civilised from where you're sitting than it is from where I'm sitting. You can walk home tonight in the dark alone and I cannot.
I'll ask you a question. Have you been a victim?
Yes, I have.
Okay, well, I can understand the way you think.
And 80% of women have.
Do you reckon it's that high?
Yeah, fucking oath I do. Yeah. Of at least some form of sexual assault.
I reckon you're broad brushing it.
Come. You can walk home tonight in the dark and I cannot.
Well, who's to say someone's not going to stab and rob me?
I'm going to say it's statistically unlikely. Statistically much more likely that I will be attacked in some way.
Yeah, I don't agree with it.
Oh, come on, Bernie. You know the stats.
I don't agree with it.
You know the stats. They just are what they are.
No, I don't agree with it.
I mean, I think there's definitely where people should not be let out ever. And I feel like some of the people in jail for life, that's the right decision. Like Leslie Camilleri.
If a rapist gets another one in 6 years, then are you going to pick which one he gets? Who can he have? Do you reckon you'd ever retire? You seem to still be getting a real buzz out of your work.
Hey, look, 95% of the time, I mean, you're dealing with people's problems on a daily basis. It wears you down from time to time. 95% of the time I love what I'm doing. Mm. Yeah. Will I retire? Probably not.
No, I can't imagine you would. I reckon you'd be a real pain around the house if you did.
Oh, huge.
Yeah, you'd be bored.
Huge. I mean, look, and you know, working the hours that I used to work, I've got a daughter who works with me now. I've got 9 employees.
Great. What does she do? Is she a lawyer?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
great.
She went through bond and she's been out about 8+ years now.
Wow. Oh, great.
She's got 4 kids.
Is she any good?
Yeah, super.
Yeah.
But no, she's got 4 kids. Her husband's a barrister, all in criminal law. All my kids work for me over the years on reception, you know, part-time and so on. So they've got a good feel for what Dad does. One of them got a bit scared during the gangland killings for my safety.
Who did you rep? Mick Gatto?
I started to represent Mick, but that I didn't go on with it in the end. Mm-hmm. But no, I had 2 others that I had to give away because one of them turned police evidence.
Ew.
Yeah, so it was sort of good to get out of it, really.
I was thinking I'd want to work for your factory. I was listening to you and I thought, maybe it's not too late for me to do a law degree. Maybe I could do like articles with Bernie when I'm like 50 or I'm 45 when I'm like 50 or 51.
Am I
too old?
Yeah, you are one of those people who makes you want to.
Yeah, I was like, cool.
I graduated with a fella who was 72.
Oh,
there's hope.
I love Cedric because he used to come up to the uni and he'd bring his tea bag and he'd have his bickies. When he went up to get the hot water, I used to eat his bickies.
Poor Cedric. Oh, my God.
But he had 2 sons who were barristers. He did, I think it was commerce at Melbourne University back in the 50s. Mm. And then he ran Phillips Radio, then retired. Then he got sick of his kids pulling ranks saying, look, I've got a law degree, what would you know? Yeah. So he went and did law.
It's pretty impressive. It is. You can do that stuff now, can't
you? And the great
you?
Thing was that at the graduation ceremony, being Zahara Zed, you don't clap until the last person gets there conferred with their degree. And, of course,
he got it.
Yeah, Cedric, yeah.
When you go back into the court, I'm going to come and watch you. We've got to get you back again, please.
Yeah, yeah.
I knew this would happen. We've wanted to talk to you for ages. Yeah, I really want to come and watch you perform.
Thank you to Bernie Barmer. His legal firm, by the way, is Barmer & Associates, and I highly recommend if ever you're in need of defence counsel.
Thanks to the following patrons: Dylan Vandenbos, Marla Kavanagh, Rebecca Adams, Andrew Turner, Rachel Hoare, and Sally Dowd.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next week.
This has been another Smart Fella production in conjunction with the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.